Good evening and welcome. This is the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, May 15th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's intro is by Kurt Schillinger, Managing Editor. In recent years, the small Gulf state of Qatar has developed a large reputation as a regional peacemaker. On Wednesday, the state carrier Qatar Airways signed a $96 billion deal with Boeing for up to 210 new wide-body jets. That's good news for a flagship American company struggling to right itself after high-profile safety failures, worker strikes, and leadership struggles. The benefits of the agreement may be more than economic, as Mary Crossan, a professor at the Ivy Business School, wrote in Forbes last year about Boeing's troubles, leadership failures. Leadership failures often result from weaknesses of character more so than competence. Boeing's opportunity to build more planes may be an opportunity to lift its governing culture, too. And now on to the first story. Trump's Qatari plane controversy puts a spotlight on Boeing. By Story Hinckley and Simon Montlake. At a press conference in Qatar on Wednesday, President Donald Trump announced a $96 billion deal between Boeing, an American plane manufacturer, and Qatar Airways for as many as 210 jets. The agreement, which was signed by the two companies' CEOs as they flanked Mr. Trump and Qatar's emir, was Boeing's largest ever order for those types of aircraft. According to the White House, the deal would support more than a million U.S. jobs during the course of production and delivery. The timetables for delivery, however, was not mentioned. Boeing has been beset by serious production delays in recent years, as the company has grappled with safety issues, worker strikes, a pandemic, and supply chain woes. The company's problems have been a particular source of irritation for the president. Since retaking office in January, Mr. Trump has publicly criticized Boeing on several occasions, saying he was very disappointed by a multi-year delay on two new presidential planes to replace the current Air Force One fleet that's been in use since the presidency of George H.W. Bush. Boeing's $3.9 billion contract with the U.S. Air Force in 2018 promised the two planes by 2024, but that has been pushed to sometime between 2027 and 2029, a holdup that perhaps encouraged Mr. Trump to look for an alternative solution. The president's announcement over the weekend that he planned to accept a luxury Boeing 747-8 jet from Qatar to use temporarily as the new Air Force One set off a firestorm of criticism, and not just from the left. Lawmakers and pundits on both sides of the aisle said the unprecedented foreign gift almost certainly would violate the Constitution's Emoluments Clause, which prohibits office holders from accepting any present from a king, prince, or foreign state without the consent of Congress. In addition, many argued allowing a Qatari plane to serve as the president's office in the air would represent a serious national security threat. Behind the controversy, however, lies a real problem for both the country's defense system and the economy. As demand for aircraft has increased at home and around the world, Boeing, America's top exporting company and the U.S. counterpart to Europe's Airbus, is struggling to make planes safely and on time, even when they're needed to replace the Commander-in-Chief's decade-old models. Look at the defense side of the Boeing business, and just about every program is way over budget and delayed, says Scott Hamilton, managing director at Liam Company, an aviation consultancy firm. It's a big issue for national security and our balance of trade. There's the T-7 Red Hawks, a Boeing trainer aircraft designed to replace the aging T-38 that the Air Force signed a contract for in 2018, that have been delayed by several years. Boeing's MQ-25 tanker drone has been delayed by a year, and there is still a ton of work to do to fly the aircraft this year, a U.S. Navy Vice Admiral said last month. And when the Boeing Starliner took off for the International Space Station in June of 2024 with two astronauts, the intended 8-day mission turned into 9 months when the Starliner was deemed unsafe for a return flight. In March, the two astronauts hitched a ride home with a rocket from Elon Musk's SpaceX. Boeing isn't the only U.S. defense contractor struggling to deliver on time, says Todd Harrison, an aerospace and defense analyst at the American Enterprise Institute. But it stands out for the sheer number of delays and cost overruns that have come, as its civil aviation division has also stumbled amid safety concerns over its 737 MAX airliners. Airbus, the world's other major plane manufacturer, has outpaced Boeing for the past five years. As America's biggest exporter, Boeing has also been hit by the tariffs recently imposed by Mr. Trump. Aircraft manufacturers run global supply chains and rely on imported parts from multiple countries. By Mr. Hamilton's calculations, Boeing stands to lose a lot more than Airbus with the tariffs. All the modifications required for the VC-25B, the aircraft that is designated as Air Force One, are carried out by Boeing alone, which must equip the plane to be able to operate during a nuclear conflict, among other specialized requirements. Critics of Mr. Trump's proposal to repurpose the luxury Gutter 747 as Air Force One say the time and money it would take to refit the aircraft and to inspect and certify it as fully secure far outweigh the benefits of the $400 million gift. Boeing signed a fixed-cost contract to deliver the two new presidential aircraft in 2018, which means that the company has to eat the cost overruns. They have every incentive to deliver this on time, but it doesn't seem to be working, says Mr. Harrison. Air Force One is not Boeing's biggest defense program, and in dollar terms is dwarfed by the Qatar Airways deal and other commercial orders. But it's a high-profile order that has incurred the wrath of the commander-in-chief and has shone a harsh spotlight on the company. This is a huge reputational issue for Boeing, says Mr. Harrison. It's also a huge issue for the U.S. defense industry, he adds. What this shows more broadly is that our defense industrial base in many areas has narrowed to just one or two potential companies. Boeing is the only U.S. company that makes wide-body aircraft. While the Qatar deal announced Wednesday is good news for a company that has not posted an annual profit since 2018, Mr. Hamilton is skeptical that the contracted fleet of 787 Dreamliner and 77X planes will be produced anytime soon. Although Boeing planned to release the 777X to airlines in 2020, this version of Boeing's wide-body jet is still awaiting approval from the Federal Aviation Administration. And the 787 Dreamliner, which has flown more than a billion passengers, more than any other wide-body commercial airplane in history, faces a backlog in production that by some estimates will take a decade to clear. It's taken Boeing 3 decades to get into the predicament it's in, says Mr. Hamilton, which means getting out of it likely won't be quick either. The past 7 years have been particularly damaging. 2 deadly crashes in 2018 and 2019, caused by a new automated control system in Boeing's 737 MAX, led the U.S. FAA and regulators around the world to ground the plane for almost 2 years. The start of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, when the demand for flying and new planes plummeted, led to thousands of layoffs at Boeing and more financial losses. An FAA ordered grounding of other Boeing jets because of manufacturing concerns. A January 2024 incident when a side panel ripped off the body of a plane minutes after takeoff, and a whistleblower's complaint a few months later only further eroded trust in the company. For Mr. Trump, the issue also seems to be a matter of comfort and style. The president has implied that the current presidential planes, in service for more than 3 decades, are embarrassingly old and not befitting the leader of the free world. You look at some of the Arab countries and the planes they have parked alongside the United States of America plane. It's like from a different planet, Mr. Trump has said. Next are news briefs. Gaza faces heightened famine risk amid talk of aid. United Nations aid officials said a quarter of Gaza's population is at risk of famine and blasted Israel for deliberately and unashamedly imposing inhumane conditions. On Wednesday, a new U.S.-backed humanitarian organization that calls itself the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation said it expects to begin aid operations in Gaza by the end of the month. It claimed agreements with Israeli officials. A detained Georgetown student was released. A federal judge on Wednesday ordered that Khan Shuri be released from immigration detention. The student was arrested March 17th near his Arlington, Virginia apartment. Officials said his visa was revoked because of his social media posts and his wife's connection to Gaza as a Palestinian American. They accused him of supporting Hamas. U.S. District Judge Patricia Tolliver Giles said she was releasing Mr. Shuri because he had substantial constitutional claims. Gavin Newsom retreats on immigrant benefits. Under the California governor's budget proposal, low-income, unauthorized adults will not be able to apply for health benefits starting next year. If approved, it would mark a significant reversal in California's embrace of immigrants without legal status. It would also align the Democrat, a potential presidential candidate, with the president. The plan contradicts the view that health care for all poor people is moral and cost-effective. Still, the state's facing a budget crunch, so he's pausing this provision of California's version of Medicaid. Narco-terrorism charges were filed against a Mexican duo. They were the first since the Trump administration designated 6 Mexican cartels as foreign terrorist organizations earlier this year. Pedro Inzunza Noriega and his son, Pedro Inzunza Coronel, linked to Mexico's powerful Sinaloa cartel, are accused of offering material support for terrorism through a smuggling operation that allegedly moves fentanyl, methamphetamine, cocaine, and heroin into the United States. Labeling cartels as terrorist organizations allows federal prosecutors to bring charges with tougher penalties against traffickers. It is unclear what evidence there is to support the charges in court. Drug overdose deaths in the U.S. continued to drop. There were 30,000 fewer in 2024 than the year before, according to provisional data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released Wednesday. An estimated 80,000 people died from overdoses last year, a 27% drop from 110,000 in 2023. Carla Hayden was named 2025 Penn Faulkner Literary Champion. Dr. Hayden was fired by President Donald Trump as Librarian of Congress, with a year left in her 10-year term. The White House cited concerning things she had done in pursuit of DEI. The library called Capitol Police after an acting librarian was named and refused entry to the president's appointees until Congress acts. Dr. Hayden was chosen for the award last year for her lifetime of literary advocacy. The ceremony is set for Thursday. She has been a devoted advocate to making sure that all of us get to enjoy the fruits of a literary life, says Gwydion Suliban, executive director of the Penn Faulkner Foundation. Next story. In Mideast, Trump finds his comfort zone. Business first, then policy. President Donald Trump's Mideast agenda indicated that business would take priority. Yet the outlines of an emerging Trump foreign policy are visible. By Howard LaFranchi. On his first international trip of his second term, President Donald Trump has indeed spent some of his four-day visit to Gulf Arab countries on diplomatic matters. He met Wednesday in Saudi Arabia with Syria's post-Assad era president and former Islamist rebel leader Ahmed al-Shara, a day after pledging to lift punishing U.S. sanctions on the civil war-devastated country. Stating in an hour-long speech in Riyadh that the United States has no permanent enemies, Mr. Trump spoke of the potential for prosperous U.S.-Iran relations if Tehran turns away from decades of violent and destabilizing regional behavior. And he has given some hints of a Middle East policy with a lighter U.S. footprint and reduced pressure on partners for diplomatic results. A comment in his Riyadh speech that Saudi Arabia will normalize relations with Israel in its own time was telling. But for the most part, America's businessman president has carried out his visit to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates like a business trip. Pursuing his America First orientation, the president announced hundreds of billions of dollars in contracts for U.S. defense industries and hundreds of billions more of Gulf investments in American artificial intelligence and microchip enterprises. Notably, Mr. Trump's billionaire emerging technologies advisor and top donor Elon Musk was on the trip. Palace in the sky. But Mr. Trump also mixed America's business and family business in ways no U.S. president ever has, and to an extent that has even raised alarms among some of his staunchest and most influential supporters. Widespread opposition to his acceptance of a $400 million jet, a palace in the sky, as a gift from Qatar, and under the pretense that it would serve as a new Air Force One, will greet him when he returns home Friday. If President Trump chose to repeat his first-term innovation and make the Gulf the first international destination of his second term, regional experts say, it's because that's where the money and a style of business Mr. Trump understands and emulates is. Trump sees the Gulf as a lot of countries with a lot of capital, with leaders willing to roll out the red carpet and host him in gilded rooms in a manner he believes he deserves, says Elizabeth Dent, a senior fellow and expert in U.S. foreign and defense policy in the Gulf at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. All the deals he's announcing fit with his America First approach, giving him big, flashy investments he can bring home and tout to his base. In Qatar, Mr. Trump announced that what he crowed is the largest order of jets in the history of Boeing, a Qatar Airways deal to buy up to 210 Boeing planes. Meeting the Qatari emir, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, in the Royal Court Building, the proprietor of the glitzy Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach, Florida, surveyed the palace's marble and complimented the emir. This is what they call perfecto, he said. President Trump again chose the Gulf because this is his happy place, says John Alterman, director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. With its glittering real estate, owned by people with connections to the rulers, in the president's mind, the Gulf is the world as it should be. Foreign policy outlines. Still, amid all the business fanfare, could be discerned the outlines of an emerging Trump foreign policy that scales back commitments, resorts to military intervention rarely but with overwhelming force when applied, and sees foreign partners in terms of what they can do for America, some experts say. They are advancing a more limited set of U.S. responsibilities, but using hard power more in carrying them out, says Daniel Benayam, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Arabian Peninsula Affairs. They are trying to do fewer things, but trying to do them more forcefully, and looking for partners to fill in the gaps. As evidence, he points to Mr. Trump's bombing of Yemen's Houthis, a targeted military intervention the president ended once he said he'd received Houthi leaders' assurances they would no longer target American-flagged cargo ships in the Red Sea and adjacent shipping lanes. Underpinning it all are Trump's three big legacy issues involving the Middle East, says Mr. Benayam, now an associate fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. He lists Iran and reaching a new deal on its nuclear program, Saudi normalization with Israel, and an Israel-Hamas war ceasefire. Some issues have seen some progress, even since the administration came in, Mr. Benayam says, pointing to initial U.S.-Iran talks, while some, like Gaza, are even farther off. The U.S. reportedly presented Iranian negotiators with a written proposal for a nuclear deal when the two sides met Sunday. Iranian officials denied the reports. President Trump said in Riyadh Tuesday that he had presented Iran with an olive branch to resolve the nuclear issue, but said it was an offer that would not last forever. Saudi normalization with Israel also seems less imminent than it did in January, when many Trump aides were suggesting a region-realigning Saudi-Israeli rapprochement could be the administration's first big foreign policy win. The long-sought diplomatic breakthrough now seems to be on hold, largely because of Israel's return to intense warfare in Gaza and the ever-darkening prospects for a two-state solution to the Palestinian issue, an outcome Saudi Arabia continues to demand. To make, not impose, peace. Mr. Trump repeatedly cast himself as a peacemaker, but not as a peace imposer, repudiating his predecessors, Republican and Democratic alike, who sought to remake the Middle East in the West's image and according to Western values. Lauding Saudi leaders for achieving a modern miracle, the Arabian way, he used his Riyadh speech to blast the neocons and nation builders who failed in Kabul and Baghdad and elsewhere. It's crucial for the wider world to know this great transformation has not come from Western intervention or flying people in beautiful planes giving you lectures on how to live and how to govern your own affairs. No, the president said. For some regional experts, Mr. Trump's all-business-all-the-time approach to the Gulf states, and to Saudi Arabia in particular, in the early months of his second term, is part of a reassuring shift from a more traditional vision of a close partnership that the first Trump administration pursued. The United States should have a normal relationship with Saudi Arabia. We don't need to treat them as a pariah state, as President Joe Biden sought to do at first, says Benjamin Friedman, policy director at Defense Priorities, a Washington think tank promoting a realist U.S. foreign policy. But at the same time, he says, President Trump in his first term was too close to the Saudis, giving them the sense they were a core ally we would henceforth intervene to defend, he says. I sense a more cautious approach to the region this term. It's going to be, we do business with them, but we do not pledge to fight for them, he adds. Ethical issues. Yet while he supports what he considers to be Mr. Trump's more realist defense relationship with the region, Mr. Friedman laments the weakening of a long-standing firewall between the nation's business and international relations and the president's personal business. Citing not just Qatar's gift of a $400 million jet, but also billions of dollars of Gulf investments in a Trump family cryptocurrency venture, he says. It's depressing to witness such a collapse of ethics and anti-corruption laws and norms. Over the short week that Mr. Trump has been away from Washington, the saga of the palace in the sky has become the focal point of a firestorm over the presidential family's business dealings and susceptibility to influence peddling. Critics note that the plush jet would require a costly and time-consuming security upgrade and systems makeover that could mean it would only serve as President Trump's Air Force One for a year at the end of his term, if at all. That means the jet, which Qatar would actually give to the Trump presidential library, would essentially become Mr. Trump's in his post-presidential private life. All of this is proving to be too much, even for some of the president's most ardent supporters in MAGA world. In his podcast on the Daily Wire this week, conservative commentator Ben Shapiro cited the taint of the jet deal and called on his listeners to honestly consider its implications. I think if we switched the names to Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, we'd all be freaking out on the right, he said. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona. 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Next story. In newly unstable world, some U.S. allies ponder going nuclear. Unsure of how far President Donald Trump will go to defend them, some U.S. allies are reconsidering their decision not to build their own nuclear weapons. By Ned Temko, London. The American atomic bombs that ended World War II 80 summers ago snuffed out tens of thousands of lives in an instant. They blighted countless others, but they also left behind a more hopeful legacy, a collective determination by world powers to avoid the use of nuclear weapons forever and to tightly limit their possession. Today, that achievement is coming under strain as never before. And while that is largely down to threats from America's nuclear-armed rivals, especially Russian President Vladimir Putin in Ukraine, there is another catalyst. It is the dramatic shift in America's relations with its closest allies that President Donald Trump has effected since his return to the White House. The stakes are more than theoretical. Last week, cross-border attacks by India and Pakistan, nuclear-armed enemies with weapons far more powerful than the bombs that devastated the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, alarmed governments worldwide by drawing perilously close to the nuclear brink. That served as a reminder of the reason the main nuclear powers have long acted to limit these weapons' spread, a consensus formalized in a 1970 nuclear non-proliferation treaty signed by more than 190 countries. Once countries get nuclear arms, there's always the danger, whether by choice or by miscalculation, that they will use them. So far, the club of nuclear-armed nations has remained small, only 9 of the world's nearly 200 countries. Yet, others may soon be knocking on the door, and not only U.S. rivals like Iran. U.S. allies in Europe and Asia have long been capable of producing nuclear arms, but have chosen not to do so. Under America's nuclear umbrella, they haven't felt the need. Now, international political turbulence is prompting some of them to reconsider. Mr. Putin's unprovoked attack on Ukraine in 2022 was the first shock. U.S. allies in Europe were well aware that Ukraine had once had nuclear arms. When the Soviet Union unraveled, the warheads on its soil made it the world's third largest nuclear power. It surrendered them in return for security guarantees from the United States, Britain, and Russia itself. The worthlessness of those guarantees threw into sharp relief the value of the nuclear deterrent that Ukraine no longer had. Intensifying Europeans' sense of vulnerability, Mr. Putin has also periodically threatened to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Still, until recently, they have trusted in the bedrock support of the U.S. as a fellow member of the transatlantic NATO alliance. Since President Trump's second term began, that trust has been eroding. He has announced tariffs on the 27 countries of the European Union, describing them this week as nastier than China. Initially, he cut out European NATO partners and Ukraine from his bid for a peace deal there, dealing directly with Mr. Putin instead. Among Russia's closest neighbors, Finland, the Baltic states, and Poland, there are growing doubts that Washington would stand by their side against an attack by Mr. Putin. Hence the impetus to rethink their nuclear policy. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, citing a profound change of American geopolitics, said recently, It is time for us to look boldly at opportunities related to nuclear weapons. France and Britain, Europe's only existing nuclear powers, have raised the idea of extending their protective nuclear umbrella to the rest of the continent. French President Emmanuel Macron, with a domestically produced nuclear arsenal, unlike Britain's missiles and submarines that are made in America, has suggested that Paris could protect its European allies. The new German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, said after his party's election victory that he wondered whether NATO would exist in its current form by the time of its summit next month. Since then, he has said he has been in serious talks on nuclear security with Mr. Macron. Similar political winds seem to be blowing in Asia, where allies have also relied until now on the U.S. as the ultimate guarantor of their security. They too have been unsettled by Mr. Trump's tariff offensive, his dismissal of allies as freeloaders, and his reluctance to support Ukraine. South Korea's Foreign Minister Cho Tae-yul said earlier this year that with the international situation developing in unpredictable directions, the idea of acquiring nuclear weapons was not off the table. Polling has suggested that a sizable majority of South Koreans agree with him. President Trump has yet to signal the sort of reinforced security commitment that might restore allies' confidence and shore up their decision to forgo nuclear arms. Still, he does strongly favor a reduction in superpower nuclear arsenals, saying recently that their unabated modernization was a colossal waste of money. He has also launched a high-profile effort to prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon. And the India-Pakistan clashes have left little doubt his administration recognizes the danger that nuclear weapons pose. At first, Washington seemed content to let the fighting play itself out. Vice President J.D. Vance said the conflict was none of our business and that the U.S. couldn't tell either side to lay down their arms. But when India struck near the headquarters of the Pakistani unit responsible for safeguarding the country's nuclear arms, reportedly prompting an emergency meeting of its security chiefs, the U.S. administration suddenly changed tack. Both Mr. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio contacted the warring sides. It was they who persuaded them to agree on a ceasefire. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona for the print disabled. Supreme Court hears birthright citizenship case. What were the key takeaways? Nationwide injunctions have become more prevalent over the past 20 years, with lawyers forum shopping for judges friendly to their cause. The Supreme Court Thursday heard a case about whether to limit their scope by Henry Gass. In a lengthy oral argument that ranged from procedural matters to questions about the Trump administration's commitment to the rule of law, the U.S. Supreme Court debated narrowing a nationwide pause of President Trump's executive order redefining birthright citizenship. Hearing one of the most important cases of the term, the justices discussed only in snatches what has the potential to be one of President Trump's most consequential executive actions. Instead, in more than 2 hours of questions, the High Court focused on a procedural issue that could have major consequences for how courts resolve lawsuits involving the federal government. The Birthright Citizenship Order, issued hours after Mr. Trump's inauguration on January 20th, would reinterpret the 14th Amendment and make the children of temporary or unlawful immigrants ineligible for automatic U.S. citizenship. 22 states and immigrant rights groups sued, and a trio of federal judges stopped the order from taking effect. Because the courts are likely to strike the order down as unconstitutional, the judges said they issued nationwide injunctions preventing it from taking effect while their rulings are appealed. It is these nationwide injunctions that the Trump administration is asking the Supreme Court to review. Specifically, the administration is arguing that the injunctions should be narrowed. While they are in effect, the government says it cannot begin detailing how the Birthright Citizenship Order would be implemented. Narrowing the injunctions would also, in theory, allow the government to begin enforcing the order in portions of the country. But this procedural question could also have profound consequences for how the federal judiciary operates. Nationwide injunctions have become increasingly common and increasingly controversial, including on the high court, but they can also play an important role in preserving the legal status quo while courts weigh major legal and constitutional questions. During the argument Thursday, the justices broadly agreed that nationwide injunctions are problematic. They disagreed, however, on what should replace them. And two conservative justices appeared sympathetic to the idea that this case, with 22 states suing, might actually merit a sweeping injunction. Why wouldn't they be entitled to an injunction of the scope of the one that has currently been entered? Justice Amy Coney Barrett asked Solicitor General D. John Sauer, who argued the case on behalf of the Trump administration. Lurking in the metaphorical corner of the argument was the question of whether the Birthright Citizenship Order is constitutional at all. It came up sparingly, but when it did, some justices appeared skeptical that the Trump administration would win on the merits. Legally and historically dubious? Animosity toward nationwide injunctions has been bipartisan. Republican and Democratic presidents alike have, in recent decades, bemoaned individual federal judges preventing their policies, such as student loan relief under President Joe Biden and immigration reform under President Barack Obama, from taking effect around the country. The increased prevalence of nationwide injunctions has, in turn, scholars agree, encouraged what is known as forum shopping by opponents of both ideologies. This animosity has reached a new height in the second Trump administration. As of late March, federal judges had issued 17 nationwide, also called universal, injunctions against Mr. Trump, according to the Congressional Research Service. With the Birthright Citizenship Order, the Trump administration argues the problem of universal injunctions has reached epidemic proportions. The Trump administration isn't alone in questioning this judicial power. The Biden administration also ran into forum shopping with 28 nationwide injunctions during its 4 years. Some justices have voiced skepticism in the past, and those justices made themselves heard this morning. Justice Clarence Thomas, who heard his 2018 concurrence stating that universal injunctions are legally and historically dubious, referenced multiple times during the argument, questioned again whether universal injunctions have a strong grounding in the U.S. legal history. So we survived until the 1960s without universal injunctions, he asked Mr. Sauer. Some legal experts argue the first nationwide injunction was issued in 1913. Others, like Mr. Sauer, say 1963. Justice Samuel Alito criticized district court judges exercising power over the entire country through nationwide orders, describing them as acting on an occupational disease. Which is the disease of thinking that I am right and I can do whatever I want, he said. But while federal judges on multi-member courts are restrained by their colleagues, he added, a trial judge sitting in a trial courtroom is the monarch of that realm. Other justices countered that universal injunctions are an important tool for the federal judiciary. The alternatives, such as individuals challenging a government action either by themselves or as a legal class, would give the government more freedom to enforce unlawful orders. Justice Sonia Sotomayor offered one hypothetical. If a president signs an order that the military confiscate every privately owned gun in the country, she asked Mr. Sauer, do we and the courts have to sit back and wait until every plaintiff whose gun is taken goes to court? Even then, some justices posited, if courts are limited to granting relief only to specific individuals or specific groups, that would mean the rest of the country is still subject to a government action while courts are determining if the action is lawful. The real concern, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said, is this turns our justice system into a catch-me-if-you-can regime, where everybody has to have a lawyer and file a lawsuit to vindicate their rights. Did I understand you correctly? In over 2 hours of argument, the debate oscillated between the practical and the profound, between procedural questions and constitutional ones, and to what extent the Trump administration would honor court decisions. According to the government, the justices here are being asked to resolve a modest request. The court should restrict the scope of the nationwide injunction, limiting them to parties actually within the court's power. But the request raises a host of broader questions. Most immediately, say the Supreme Court does restrict the nationwide injunctions in the birthright citizenship case. What then? In this case, and in future cases, where large numbers of people claim they are being targeted by an unlawful action, what emergency relief could federal courts provide? One option would be for a court to allow a group of similarly situated individuals to file a class action lawsuit against the government, a process known as the Federal Code, in the Federal Code as Rule 23. A second option would be to allow states to ask for emergency relief. A third option would be for the courts to rule on the merits of the action much faster than normal, a solution that Chief Justice John Roberts seemed to favor. We've been able to move much more expeditiously than in the past, he said. I think we did the TikTok case in a month. Several justices questioned if these replacements were workable or if they would preserve nationwide injunctions in all but name. If Rule 23 actions and state lawsuits could proceed, Justice Alito asked, would the practical problem be rectified to any substantial degree? Another problem that justices confronted was the Trump administration's ongoing reluctance to follow lower court orders it disagrees with. For the first time since Mr. Trump began his second term, justices questioned the administration directly about this purported defiance. While claiming that Rule 23 would be an appropriate tool to address emergency situations, Mr. Sauer conceded that the Trump administration would also challenge some class certifications under the rule's appropriately rigorous criteria. He also suggested to Justice Kagan that the administration may not feel bound to follow an appeals court ruling if it provided relief beyond the parties involved in the case. After a few minutes in which Justice Brett Kavanaugh dug into how the birthright citizenship order would be implemented on the ground, Justice Barrett circled back. "Did I understand you correctly that the government wanted to reserve its right to maybe not follow Second Circuit precedent because you might disagree?" she asked Mr. Sauer. "This raises the potential for a catch-22," Justice Elena Kagan noted. "Resolving an emergency lawsuit against the federal government sort of depends on the government's own actions," she said. "If a discrete group successfully blocks an executive order from being enforced against them, the government has no incentive to appeal the case to the Supreme Court, because it's not really losing," she added. "The government can still enforce its order against the vast majority of people to whom it applies. The court is expected to issue a decision by the end of June." Next story. Motivated and inspired. California inmates are improving mental health behind bars. 4 years after two incarcerated men sought ways to help their peers face mental health issues, Los Angeles County is expanding their successful efforts. By Francine Kiefer, Los Angeles. For years, the Los Angeles County Jail has been known as the United States' largest mental health institution. An astonishing 5,901 people, nearly half of its population, struggle with mental health issues. In some parts of the jail, incarcerated individuals in quilted robes are chained to metal tables so they can't harm themselves or others. For years, the U.S. Department of Justice has been monitoring the jail system, also the nation's largest, to assess its mental health care. And yet, it's making progress, particularly with a peer-to-peer program called Forensic Inpatient, or FIP, step down that the monitor reported on 4 years ago. Since then, the nascent program has grown more than sixfold overall, spreading to the women's jail. Incarcerated people trained as mental health assistants are helping hundreds of others with severe mental illness who are held at the same facility. The California state prison system, long under federal court orders to improve mental health care, is taking notice. Many familiar with the county program see it as a national model. The mental health assistance program, initiated by two people who were facing criminal charges, is amazing, says Alex McLaren, a former Federal Bureau of Prisons executive. "What I think is most amazing about it is that it was started by the peers themselves instead of brought down from on high," says the clinical psychologist. "Top-down mandates often founder for lack of buy-in," she explains. With the dismantling of America's psychiatric hospitals, jails and prisons are the de facto mental hospitals in many cases, says Dr. McLaren. She describes mental health care in carceral settings as a crisis, though not a new one. 41% of all state and federal prisoners surveyed in 2016 had a history of a mental health problem, according to the most recent numbers from the Bureau of Justice Statistics. That's nearly twice the percentage of the U.S. general population in recent years. Staffing of mental health professionals and physicians is a challenge throughout the correctional system. Peer support can't replace those positions, says Dr. McLaren, but it can fill some really big gaps. It increases self-esteem and social functioning while decreasing mental health symptoms and crisis hospitalizations. She's particularly impressed that this program is flourishing in a jail because jails have high population churn. Sparkling clean in Tower 1. It's double scrub Monday at the Twin Towers Correctional Facility in downtown Los Angeles. The towers, part of the county jail system, house the greatest concentration of men with severe mental illness. More than 1,200 who struggle with conditions such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and substance use disorder. Many are homeless. Their offenses range from murder to trespassing. Here on the fourth floor of Tower 1, some of these men have been released from the jail's FIP hospital into the FIP step-down mental health program. Here, the patients get professional psychiatric help. They learn basic hygiene, like toothbrushing. When allowed out of their cells to move freely in a common area, they work on communication and social skills, and they learn about the court. Our main goal is to get them ready for court, says Sergeant Julian Flores of the L.A. County Sheriff's Department, a driving force behind the program. The judges won't want to see someone they can't comprehend or who is unable to stand trial. That's where the Double Scrub Monday and a unique role for Cragen Armstrong comes in. Several years ago, Mr. Armstrong and another person now in state prison, Adrian Berumen, pioneered the idea of inmate mental health assistance. The duo lived 24/7 with peers in acute need and wanted to help them. With the support of an on-site psychiatric technician and the county sheriff's department, among others, the two men became a trusted bridge between the incarcerated patients and the professionals. At 8 a.m. on a recent Monday, Mr. Armstrong led the patients in scrubbing their two-story pod of 16 cells from top to bottom. Then it was on to behavioral group therapy in the center of the room, with patients sitting on oversized soft chairs under a hand-painted banner that spells out LOVE in big red letters, followed by each other better. Double scrub is about personal responsibility, self-development, says Mr. Armstrong, emerging from the gleaming module. Whatever you do, do it 100%. And then it's about teamwork and daily hygiene. It may look like we're cleaning, but it represents those three principles. Patients who complete their weekly checklists from double scrub to group therapy to teeth cleaning get rewards like personal radio and video time, pizza, and cheeseburgers. Practicing what he calls the magic of love, Mr. Armstrong spends hours listening to them and talking them down from crisis. He knows the rewards that motivate each one, and he has success, for example, persuading them to take their medication, though he cannot administer it. Mr. Armstrong says that his work as a mental health assistant has restored a sense of value to both his and his patients' lives. It is the main ingredient to rehabilitation, because without that sense of value, it's easier to degrade and harm yourself and others, he says. Results have far exceeded expectations. When the Monitor reported on FIP step-down in May 2021, four mental health assistants operated in three pods. helping about 70 patients at Tower 1. At that check-in, self-harming had dropped to 6 times less than in other units, according to county medical mental health officials. Returns to the forensic hospital, a specialized psychiatric facility, were down by 35%. Beyond the statistics, the results shone in the patients' relaxed faces. They weren't banging their heads against the wall, as elsewhere in the jail. They weren't throwing feces. Rapid growth. Sorry, I've gone over time. That's it for today, Thursday, May 15th, 2025. Thanks for listening. Good night.